Hey there, everyone. It's VOA's Asia Weekly for Friday, the 13th of May. Ooh, what an ominous sounding date. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Thank you so much for joining me this week. Now, coming up on the podcast, Rodrigo Duterte, the controversial candidate who has spoken about rape and participating in extrajudicial killings, looks to have won the Philippines election. Now, is it all doom and gloom in the island archipelago, like the headlines have said? Plus, the bullying of LGBT students in Japan and beyond. I go behind the headlines of a new Human Rights Watch report. But first up this week, China, the South China Sea, and the world. There is a lot to discuss this week surrounding the South China Sea. Now, to get the skinny on what's going on, I phoned up Scott Harold, Associate Director of the RAND Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. Hello, Scott. This is Steve Miller.
Oh, man, Steve. Good to hear from you.
While a lot of press has been given to the passage of the USS William P. Lawrence conducting a freedom of navigation exercise through the South China Sea and the predictable Chinese response that called the action provocative, China was also concurrently carrying out military drills. Now, to be fair, the U.S. and other nations have drilled in the South China Sea, so are China's drills simply business as usual? Scott says that while China claimed their territory with the now famous nine-dash line, they never really clarified
what the dashes on the waters in the South China Sea constitute, but they're beginning increasingly to put forces afield or afloat that can enter into those areas.
So what's giving China the opportunity and capacity to further state their claim? Scott says it boils down to military modernization. And that is something we've actually seen in recent years. China has increased its defense spending, built new aircraft carriers, and analysts have even detailed the specs on so-called aircraft carrier killing missiles. Harold also explains that the built-up islands allows other assets to
potentially sustain and support those exercises and that presence from these new geographic features that they have constructed by grinding up living coral and dumping sand and cement on top of it to create anything from naval installations to runways capable of landing fighter aircraft.
But these drills are a little different. For the first time, forces stationed on the Spratly and Paracel Islands have joined the larger group. Remember, these are contested areas. So does this mean that Beijing is trying to send some sort of message?
I think there's, you know, an element of this that is longstanding, but was long unable to be realized due to China's weakness. And there is a sense now that China has gotten stronger, that they want to begin to start claiming things that they had long claimed but been unable to. Support, as well as, frankly, to begin changing the facts on the water by creating new facilities and changing the ways in which other countries operate in that space that China wants to own.
Going beyond the drills to the question of who this area actually belongs to, there was, let's just say, a surprising development. Taiwan filed documents with the International Court of Arbitration, as that body is in the final stages of a case between the Philippines and China. It's a head-scratching move because Taiwan isn't part of the case. It's not a signatory to UNCLOS, the United Nations Convention on Laws of the Sea, and doesn't have widespread diplomatic recognition. And the Ma government in Taiwan will be out of office in a week. So why? Well, Scott had some thoughts.
Because it, as I said, comes so late and in some ways would appear to be both potentially concerning to China, since China doesn't want Taiwan to have the right to file anything in international courts for fear that it might suggest that Taiwan is an independent state with standing to participate in these matters. On the other hand, it also may be welcomed by Beijing insofar as it appears to sustain the Chinese-ness of these claims and to put Taipei and Beijing, at least briefly for the next week, on the same page confronting the Philippines.
When the Court of Arbitration finally does release its decision, something expected later this month, what does Scott think Beijing will do? Well, China has said it will not acknowledge any decision that goes against them.
So for now, I'd say I wish I could be more hopeful, Steve, but I don't see a lot of signs that China is looking to find a way to compromise on its previous position, which it claims is principled, that it will not abide by any international tribunal that is assessing the validity of its extensive, ambitious claims to essentially all of the South China Sea.
And speaking of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, the presumptive president-elect in the Philippines, whom I'll be speaking about later in the podcast, has said a number of things related to how he may actually deal with this territorial dispute. Duterte has said he'd be willing to work with Beijing, who has replied in kind, and Duterte has said he'd even offer up the region to be shared so that both nations could benefit from the natural resources contained within. That's a course of action the United States did comment on, saying it had consistently expressed support for nations to exercise peaceful means to resolve territorial or maritime disputes without the use of force, intimidation, or coercion. If we take a broader view outside of this little pocket in the world, China has pledged $1 billion to the United Nations. To that end, Beijing will pay $20 million a year for the next decade to help fund peace, security, and development activities. And this comes as another announcement was made. China will be sending a special envoy to visit Djibouti, where China is establishing a naval logistics center. So the question really is, will we see a more globally engaged China? And are these UN activities really any different than, say, what the United States or other nations do?
I think the answer to the latter half of your question is definitely yes, it is different. That's not to say that it's completely different, but I think that, yes, we will continue to see, as long as China's national economy continues to grow, as long as their is a modicum of political stability. In other words, the Chinese Communist Party remains in power and the economy's not collapsed and China continues to rise, then yes, I think especially under this administration of Xi Jinping, you're seeing an attempt to be much more activist in foreign policy. I think that this leadership is much more, at least Xi Jinping personally, much, much more confident and much more a firm believer that China's rise should be accompanied by greater voice and influence in international organizations, including in rule setting and in shaping the international context in which China exists.
So looking at the United States and other nations, Harold says, sure, it's what the U.S. and other nations do.
But China's efforts to do this are in many ways much, much more self-serving, I think, or narrowly focused on China's interests and less confident with the broad swath of international norms and opinions than, say, the more liberal internationalism of the United States post-World War II.
So will China ever change its approach?
It will remain a project for all of us to watch to see if China can ultimately begin to move in that direction. I would not anticipate them doing so anytime soon, probably not under this leadership, but maybe not ever, given the more narrowly politically focused interests of the Chinese Communist Party and its vision of world order.
The dust is beginning to settle from Monday's Philippines national elections. Now, as I mentioned last week on the podcast, frontrunner Rodrigo Duterte cruised to an easy victory. According to the Comelec Transparency Survey, which has about 96% of the votes tallied thus far, Duterte has garnered more than 6 million votes than his closest competitor. Now, to better understand how a mayor got elected to the office of president, I phoned up Gerald Finan, senior fellow at the East-West Center, and asked him, what made Duterte such a popular candidate far beyond his home base?
Well, I think it's important to put things in context. So unlike many other electoral systems, in the Philippines, there is a tradition of not having particularly strong political parties. And therefore, rather than having two contestants, as we might have here in the United States, or two major contestants, there were four major contestants in the Philippine race. And so while it's true that Mr. Duterte has won the election, it's also true that he won with about 38 or 39% of the vote.
Finan notes that President Aquino, who has called Duterte a threat to democracy, tried to create a coalition against the Davao mayor by bringing together both Rojas and Po and other leading candidates. But that didn't happen. But Duterte is a candidate that has spoken about rape and actually being involved in extrajudicial killings. Didn't those activities raise any red flags?
I think they are for the majority of the Filipinos, but there was a certain number who were keen on having someone who they saw as a strong leader. And so a democratic election was held, and by all accounts, it was a free and fair election, and he was the person who came out with the largest number of votes.
And that is important to keep in mind. He didn't win a majority of the overall votes cast, but simply the most of those cast for the office of president. Sure, Duterte has more than a 6 million vote edge over Rojas and Poe, but it's a far cry from a 50+1% majority. Whether or not this type of system is good for the Philippines, Finan says that's a whole nother discussion. But the point he makes is that the vote shouldn't necessarily be interpreted as a clear and decisive directive from the people. Now, during the campaign, Duterte made headlines for saying he'd bring crime to a halt by killing criminals and issuing pardons to police officers and others involved. He even joked that he'd be willing to give himself a pardon. But the Philippines is a nation of laws. Finan believes those institutions will still endeavor to fulfill their functions, and
we all know people say a lot of things in campaigns that don't happen down the road. So I think we have to, rather than speculate about all sorts of doomsday scenarios, take a wait-and-see attitude and see what kind of leader he really becomes, moving from the position of a city mayor to the president of a country with a population of over 100 million.
Which brings up an interesting point. Duterte has been mayor of Davao. It's a city of about 1.5 million, and now he'll be tasked to lead a country of over 100 million. Does his time as the head of a municipality, and one that the U.S. State Department has travel advisories against, does that time as mayor serve as a good predictor of how this man could lead the country?
Well, there is some evidence there, but I think we have to hope for the best, and there will be major changes in the way in which he has to operate as a president. Certainly as the mayor, he didn't have much work in the field of international relations, and now he has a whole international community that he has to work with. He has to address issues like the West Philippine Sea. And so it's really a new ball game for him. And I think what we can say at this point is we're wishing that things will continue to go well for the Philippines, even though they have selected a highly unusual person to be their next president.
Speaking to the question of how President-elect Duterte may interact with the international community, especially after calling the U.S. and Australian ambassadors idiots, Finan says Duterte could face challenges, but then again, the world has to deal with all sorts of leaders, but
one would think that the interests of the Philippines will be first and foremost in terms of how he interacts with the international community. And, you know, there are a lot of issues that he's probably not given all that much thought to. So there's going to be a steep learning curve as he moves forward.
The elephant in the room, so to speak, is, of course, China, and the case that's nearing its completion in the International Court of Arbitration. As I've mentioned previously on the podcast, Duterte has expressed willingness to discuss the issue directly with China, and at least for the time being, Beijing has replied in kind. This, of course, is before the ruling comes down, and things could potentially change. However, Finan states that even though Duterte may not have extensive experience on the diplomacy scene, he will have access to professionals who have been working on this particular issue for years. Whatever does transpire,
one hopes that the incoming president, Mr. Duterte, will keep an open mind on some of these matters.
So is it all doom and gloom like some of the headlines?
There are people saying that tonight. You know, that seems to be some of what's going around. And I think there's enough institutional coherence and strength at this point in time that things could turn out to be much better than some are predicting. At this point, it's all speculation because he just has so little experience on the national scene.
Human Rights Watch released a report entitled "The Nail That Sticks Out Gets Hammered Down." Kyle Knight has his name attached to it, and he's a researcher on LGBT rights at that organization. Kyle, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Kyle, this report just isn't a story about being different, but talks about a bigger and broader issue. What did it identify?
Well, the title kind of says it all. And what we were able to identify in interviewing LGBT youth in Japan is that not only do they face an extremely hostile environment in schools, but there's also a general lack of information. It's not only that LGBT issues are not included in the national curriculum, but they're not included in teacher training either.
But I mean, Japan is largely a private nation, right?
I mean, it is. And I think one of the weaknesses we've found in how the government likes to combat issues like school bullying and discrimination is to uphold the idea that everyone is the same by enforcing that everyone should act the same. Let me tell you this. For example, in the National Bullying Prevention Policy, one of the proposals for preventing bullying in school is to teach kids on social norms, teach kids how to act more normal. And this is how what we found over and over and over again in our interviews with kids is that if they acted slightly different, if they stood out because they expressed their sexual orientation or gender identity, even if they were just asking questions about these things as they were trying to learn more, they were bullied mercilessly by their peers, and teachers were onlookers or even participants in these incidents.
Okay, so this speaks to my next question. I mean, since, you know, they're teaching essentially how to be normal, and we're talking about individuals that sometimes fall outside those norms, how did you gain the level of trust to have these important conversations without them feeling there may be some reprisal?
Well, this is an issue we face all over the world where we research with an extremely marginalized population. In this particular instance in Japan, one of the most important ways that we reached out to young people was through social media. It was on Twitter, and it happened because there was an interview we had conducted. We'd been put in touch with this person through a peer network. And right after the interview, we noticed as we were riding away on the bus that the person was tweeting about it. And this
was a teenage girl.
Yeah, it was great. And she was saying, it was so great. This is the first time I've ever had an adult listen to my story and take it seriously and ask me questions about how I felt when I was looking different at school and bullied because of it. So then what we did is we created an online form. We listed some of the questions we were interested in, and we encouraged people to fill it out. And at the end, we said, if you're interested, we can keep your name private. We can keep the location of the interview private. We can interview you basically on your own terms, so that you are comfortable. We'd love to meet you and really do a deep dive interview on this issue. And that's how we met a lot of the kids that we interviewed for this report.
Now, based on what you've found, what you've seen in historical information, where is Japan going? Because you take districts like Shibuya that does allow same-sex marriages.
Well, Japan has this incredible moment this year for an incredible opportunity for a number of reasons. And exactly like you point out, local governments in Japan have started to recognize same-sex relationships. So it's not quite a legalization, but it's an acknowledgement from local administrations that this is something that's important. You also have municipalities in other parts of the country, including in Okinawa, for example, who have put themselves forward as LGBT-friendly cities. This is something they want to be proud of to attract tourists, to support their citizens. I was at Tokyo Pride last weekend, and it was the biggest march they've ever had. And no longer is it just a few ambassadors who get up on stage to talk about their relationships with Japan as a great democracy and as a country that gives opportunity for everyone. But it's Japanese people. It's organizations speaking out. It's young people speaking out. And I think that was such an incredibly powerful thing for us to see. And it's one of the reasons we did this research. Japan has an opportunity to really be a regional leader in Asia on so many of these issues. And this year, not only are they revising the National Bullying Prevention Policy, which is something that we're pushing them on to really include LGBT students, but they're also considering sexual orientation-based non-discrimination legislation. And in the meetings we had with government officials and elected officials who are working on this, there's a really encouraging tone to it. There's not a negativity. There's a fluency that comes about these issues and a desire to really support the LGBT population in their country.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, if we look beyond just Japan, what do we see related for this issue across Asia?
Well, it's definitely a mixed bag. I mean, you could look in countries like Nepal, which late last year, where it became the 10th country in the world to include sexual orientation and gender identity protections in its constitution. They had an openly gay elected official for a number of years, and those two things are definitely related. And then you could look at the meltdown that happened earlier this spring in Indonesia, where you had about a dozen government officials openly slurring LGBT people and LGBT rights activism, which corresponded with an uptick in attacks on LGBT people in their communities, attacks on NGOs that work on these issues, and a couple of decrees that came out from government ministries ranging from a ban on effeminate behavior on television from men all the way through to sort of a gay propaganda ban that echoed some of the things we've seen out of Russia. So it's really a mixed bag across the region. I think what stands consistent is that you have an incredible civil society that's taking this seriously. And the people I work with are not only courageous in sort of the discrimination they face every day and some of the tougher things that they have to go up against, but it's also amazing in the alliances they've built with mainstream human rights organizations, pro-democracy organizations, women's organizations, and this understanding that the LGBT rights movement is no longer a marginal or a movement that operates on its own, but it really is integrated into the progressive future of so many of these countries.
All right. Kyle Knights with Human Rights Watch, thank you so much for your time.
Take care. Thanks.
Okay, one last story before we go. The White House has announced that President Obama will visit Hiroshima. Now, this is a historic trip, as he will be the first sitting U.S. president to visit the site. But was it a surprising development? No. Secretary of State John Kerry foreshadowed the visit during the foreign minister's G7 summit. Now, Mr. Obama doesn't plan on apologizing for the use of atomic weapons during the Second World War, but will rather use the visit to make a statement about the United States' close ties with Japan, their united future, and the dangers of nuclear proliferation. But one question does remain. Will his visit overshadow the G7 summit? All right, my friends, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for joining me. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do me a huge favor and share it with your friends and family. I'd also like to hear from you and what you think about what's going on in the South China Sea, the Philippines and its elections, and LGBT issues in Asia and around the globe. So please hit me up on Twitter. I'm at Steve Miller VOA there, or you can find me on Facebook at Stephen G. Miller 42. Why the 42? Because 42 is the answer for everything, my friends. Thanks again for listening. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.